morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Monday, October 7th, 2024. An activist says scores of people in Unity State are trapped in floodwaters, but help is on the way.
State government with the partners are working to support some of the efforts, though much is needed.
And a South Sudanese student living in Ethiopia says no one was expecting an earthquake yesterday.
In the building where I was, exactly the library, it was actually surprising and it was not that dangerous. There were no damages and injuries.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Floodwaters have hit both the southern and northern parts of Unity State, destroying thousands of homes and affecting an unknown number of residents. A civil society activist is calling for support to women and children in particular, who have been trapped in water for some 2 weeks now. Malwal Bol Kir tells VOA's John Tanza that if little else is done, waterborne diseases will be on the rise in many areas affected by the floods.
The flood has affected thousands of people. It started in the previous months in southern Unity, but now it has hit within northern Unity State, especially in far western Mayom County, in areas like Rodnibor, Kweye, Toiloka. So those areas have recently, thousands have been displaced together with their cattle as well.
And what are the interventions from both state and national government? We have a Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management. What have they done to address this situation?
So far, the state government, together with the partners on the ground, are working to support the communities which took it upon themselves to battle this natural disaster. For example, the partners are supplying, they have supplied 10,000 sandbags in the three counties which were previously affected, which were first hit by these inundating floods, areas like Paingiar County, Lair County, and Mayanet County. So the partners provided them with 10,000 sandbags, which are used as defenses for flood waters. So the state government with the partners are working to support some of the efforts, though much is needed. And the recent hit within northern Unity State, the communities are working, so there is a need for partners also to get involved with the local authorities to support the communities that are volunteering, that took it upon themselves to build dikes and build defenses against the waters.
And, you know, this is happening in the backdrop of a situation where Unity State is oil-producing state, and according to the Petroleum Act, some states that produce oil get 3% from the oil revenue for their own development. What are authorities doing to do this, to mitigate the situation?
What the authority is doing is working with the partners. In regards to the 3% of the oil share for the community of Unity State, to my knowledge, the Unity State have not received this amount.
You know, health experts say when you live in water, you are at the risk of contracting waterborne diseases. Could you tell us about the situation of these people who are stranded in Unity State?
Yeah, definitely. That's a excellent opinion from the health expert. And yes, so the stagnant water is really very dangerous for the health of the community. And I would just call the health experts to do more and to see how they can support these affected communities, especially in terms of supplying medical aids and seeing that they continue to provide advice and guidance to the displaced population.
A lot of places in South Sudan are experiencing floods. Why are you so particular about Unity State? It's my understanding that Lake State is going through the same problem. And Jonglei State is also going through the same problem. Why Unity State only?
I am so much concerned about the entire South Sudan. But I raised this issue of Unity State because of my experience in Unity State. I have visited Unity State. I've seen firsthand how devastating this flood has been to the to the communities and to the population that we have. So it is something that I have seen and I have experienced. That's why I'm so much particular about it. But I'm very much concerned about the situation within South Sudan at large.
Floods have been a frequent occurrence in some parts of South Sudan, especially Unity State, Jonglei. What are the authorities doing to prevent this from happening in future?
To my understanding, the authorities is currently engaging with the partners to see to it that there is a need for intervention within this emergency situation. But there is no much that has been done in terms of durable solution to the current of this. So now people are battling with the emergency situation that is affecting the people.
That is civil society activist Maluwa Bolkir speaking with my colleague John Tanza from Unity State. A 4.9 magnitude earthquake on Sunday hit the Ethiopian Rift Valley and several other areas in the country, including Addis Ababa, sending some residents running for shelter. South Sudanese student Mawau Mo, who studies business management at Andenet International College in Addis Ababa, says he saw his room shake while the tremor rattled dishes, windows, and doors. Dennis Lagonye reports for VOA from Juba.
The 4.9 magnitude earthquake sparked fear among some South Sudanese students in Ethiopia who experienced a quake for the first time. Mawau Mo is a student of business management at Andenet International College, Ethiopia. He says he saw his room shaking as the quake rattled dishes, windows and doors.
It was like between 8 and 9, so I was just inside reading. Then all of a sudden the building started to shake. I was surprised. I was like, what's the problem? Then my friend was in the sitting room. I asked them, so what's the problem? Why the building is shaking? So then one of my friends told me that I heard before that there's an earthquake in Ethiopia, but it is not that much, it is normal. That's why the building is shaking. We felt a pressure because the building was shaking badly. Even our clothes fell down from the cupboard.
Margot Chol is in his third year, student of law studies at Addis Ababa University. He says he was surprised, but he calmed down later.
We felt some shaking around our university and even in the building where I was, exactly the library. It was actually surprising and it was not that dangerous. There were no damages and injuries since the tremor was just hot and the main place where the earthquake happened was Awach.
The chairperson of the South Sudanese community in Ethiopia called on the students to take emergency precautions. Margot Chol asked students to stay updated with information from local media.
It would be good for students, South Sudanese who are in different universities, to make sure they prioritize their safety. And safety must first start with individuals. In case of such scenario, if you get information early before time, you have to monitor and keep updated to information on ground.
According to the United States Geological Survey, which tracks earthquakes worldwide, the quake's epicenter was in Awash, Ethiopia, about 200 kilometers east of the capital Addis Ababa. There were no reports of significant injuries or damage, although residents reported buildings shaking as far away as Addis Ababa. According to the Volcano Discovery website, weak shaking likely was felt hundreds of kilometers from Addis Ababa. A week ago, a smaller series of earthquakes occurred in several parts of Ethiopia, but no major damage was reported. Nyok Riak, a third-year student of business management at Andenet International College, says he was worried after what happened in Morocco last year. An earthquake in a mountainous region killed about 3,000 people there a year ago.
This is the second time in Ababa since I came here. We planned it at 8 yesterday. It was something surprising all of us when we come at exactly at 8, but we were not informed about it. It was indeed something that is worrying us. We were like, this thing here will affect all of us, and those who are in the big buildings will be affected like what happened in Morocco earlier this year. It fell differently. Some students are saying that it is not really those who are not within Addis Ababa, but for us, those in Addis Ababa, we fell.
Hundreds of South Sudanese are studying in Ethiopian institutions of higher education. Some are on Ethiopian government scholarships, while others depend on their families for school fees. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
Tunisia's president, Kais Saied, says he'll wait for official results before declaring victory in yesterday's election. But exit polls show him winning by a landslide. Only 27.7% of the electorate went to the polls yesterday. William Lawrence, a former diplomat in Tunisia and North Africa director of the National Council on U.S.-Arab Relations, is in Tunis. He tells me that most Tunisians were not interested in this election.
This is half the participation rate as when Saied was the first elected in 2019. And while it's comparable with the participation rate when the new constitutional referendum, which is that constitution Saied wrote himself, passed, a little better than the 11% turnout for the last legislative elections, which were, I think, the second lowest in the history of modern democracies or modern voting. And so there's a general disgust of Tunisians with politics, and so they're either voting with Saied because of their disgust, or they're just not voting because they're disgusted. I must have talked with, you know, well over 100 people coming into Tunisia and around, and most of the people I talked to weren't voting. Now, the ones that were voting, only a few were voting for the opposition candidates, because the three viable opposition candidates were all excluded. Nine candidates had various legal actions against them. Several were in jail. I think a total of 17 were excluded, and the two they allowed through, they put one in jail.
The president, Kais Saied, he imprisoned two of his main opponents earlier, like you mentioned, including a businessman. What can you tell us about those two men?
So all of these were trumped up charges. They were all invented. All the, you know, judicial and human rights and press organizations said so. And it's just part of a systematic effort by the police in Tunisia to execute the president's wishes by muzzling the opposition. There are over 170 political prisoners now. Over 1,000 people have been arrested and detained since the coup. And the entire parliament shut down and replaced with a yes-man parliament under new rules that allows them to control the parliament. And so no one takes the charges seriously.
You know, civil society leaders, lawyers, journalists, others have called this election a sham. Does the outside world see it that way? And if so, will there be any repercussions, do you think, for Saied?
Those that pay attention do. Most don't pay attention, you know. Tunisia is rather inconsequential in world affairs, and that's a long descent from the Tunisia that won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2015 after the historic saving of democracy in the 2013-14 period, becoming the only Arab democracy and the only very successful outcome of the Arab Spring. But because of the personality and style of the president, and I've met with senior officials from several governments here, including our own, because of the his style, they don't see any reason to push him harder or try to get him to change course, because he's not listening.
You're there in Tunis, and you were just driving around in your car, you told me just a few minutes ago. What is it like on the streets? Are most people celebrating?
Nope, didn't see any celebrations at all. I saw some reported in the news, but I was downtown all around since the election hadn't happened. And interestingly, you know, I was an observer in the 11 and 14 elections, and you know, there's usually and has been around during the 19 elections and the 18 municipal elections, under which I saw a lot of the political campaign. There's usually a lot of paraphernalia and posters and leaflets and all of that, you know, the day after the election. Nothing. You'd have no sense that an election had happened at all. In fact, a lot of international people remarked that it was interesting to have a presidential campaign without a campaign.
That is William Lawrence, a former U.S. diplomat to Tunisia. He's also North Africa director of the National Council on U.S.-Arab Relations and a political science professor at American University here in Washington. He was speaking to me this past hour from the Tunisian capital, Tunis. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, cases of mpox are rising across Africa. What are health experts doing about it? Find out when we come back. You're listening listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. As cases of mpox continue to rise across Africa, public health experts are sounding the alarm, saying more needs to be done to contain the viral outbreak. At the same time, there is a new outbreak of Marburg virus. From the capital in Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Speaking during an online news briefing Thursday, African health experts said the continent is battling two major outbreaks, mpox and Marburg. Sabine Sansimana is Rwanda's Minister of Health.
As of today, we've confirmed 36 cases of Marburg, and unfortunately, we've lost 11 people. More than 8% of these cases are healthcare providers. The healthcare workers, most of the time, it's unfortunate, but it's a reality that they are the first to be affected by such diseases because they face sick people from different places, different backgrounds.
Rwanda last month confirmed its first cases of Marburg disease, a viral hemorrhagic fever that can be deadly. On Thursday, the health ministry confirmed it is working with the World Health Organization and pharmaceutical companies to begin clinical tests of new vaccines to fight Marburg. Meanwhile, cases of mpox continue to rise across the African continent. Jean Kaseya is the Director General of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Africa CDC.
Unfortunately, we have a new country that declared mpox this week. This is Ghana. That brings a total of 16 African member states affected. If we compare the same period, 2023 and 2024, there is an increase in terms of cases of 201%. It means the outbreak is still not controlled.
The Africa CDC is the public health agency of the African Union, and it supports countries in their efforts to strengthen health systems and improve surveillance and emergency response. The African region is experiencing an unprecedented increase in mpox cases, with more countries previously unaffected by the disease reporting cases. But there are concerns about getting accurate case counts. The United States is among the major donors that have committed billions of dollars to support the global response to the mpox outbreak. Again, Jean Kaseya.
In terms of funding, last week was a successful week. We managed to raise around $1.1 billion. Out of that, 500 came from the U.S., 129 came from Pandemic Fund.
In August, the World Health Organization declared a public health emergency of international concern because of the surge of mpox cases. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Everyone in Israel has been affected by the last year of war. Many have lost loved ones. Others had their homes and communities destroyed during the Hamas attack on October 7th. VOA visited some of the hardest hit sites. Linda Gradstein reports from Israel along the Gaza border.
For Talma Atsili, it's still October 7th, 2023. Her son Aviv was killed as he fought hundreds of Hamas gunmen who stormed their kibbutz near Oz, less than a kilometer from the Gaza border. Aviv's remains are still being held hostage in Gaza, so a temporary grave has been set up for him at the kibbutz.
I can't even think of what will be here, both in terms of security and in terms of the emotional strength required to return to a place that has absorbed so much loss. I very much enjoyed walking barefoot, both inside the kibbutz and in the fields, and now I have this sort of feeling that the land here is soaked in blood, and how can I continue to walk barefoot?
One quarter of near Oz's residents were killed or taken hostage, and more than half the homes destroyed. In nearby Kibbutz Be'eri, more than 100 residents were killed, among them Hagi Avni, a father of five and member of the Be'eri security squad. His nine-year-old daughter, Eliel, writes his name on the wall of her former room.
I miss my daddy. I wanted to say goodbye to my house before they destroy it and rebuild it.
But many residents of Be'eri and other Gaza border communities doubt that they will move back in.
The question is how to live here with some kind of arrangement.
like with Egypt and Jordan.
A year on, hostage families still stage mass protest rallies demanding that the Israeli government bring back some 100 remaining hostages. Avichai Brodich from Kibbutz Kfar Aza began the protest movement days after his wife and three young children were taken hostage on October 7th. His family was released in the November hostage deal. But speaking at the ruins of his kibbutz, Brodich says Israeli society still feels the trauma.
As a nation, we have to remember this as part of the Jewish history to remember. But personally, if you ask me, I'd like to live my life, you know, just look forward, live in peace. You know, after we suffered so much, I think we have a good opportunity to do it now. You know, both sides suffered so much.
But a year later, a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release seem far away. For those in Israel missing loved ones and their lost communities, October 7th, 2023 is never ending. Linda Gradstein, VOA News in the Gaza border communities.
With less than a month to go now until the U.S. presidential election, the Democratic and Republican presidential nominees have a busy week ahead of them. Former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris are both scheduled to continue rallying supporters in key states amid warnings that the rhetoric is becoming more inflammatory. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump was defiant Saturday while addressing his supporters at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. It was the same area where a shooter wounded him in July during an assassination attempt. He stressed that the incident, the first of two attempts on his life, only made him more determined to win the presidential election.
Over the past 8 years, those who want to stop us from achieving this future have slandered me, impeached me, indicted me, tried to throw me off the ballot, and who knows, maybe even tried to kill me.
House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican, was asked to comment on Trump's remarks and similar ones made over the weekend by the former president's son, Eric.
I don't think they're saying that the Democratic Party tried an assassination attempt. I think what they're alluding to is what we've all been saying. They have got to turn the rhetoric down.
Meanwhile, Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris has been juggling her duties as vice president with her campaign schedule. On Saturday, she was in North Carolina pledging federal support to communities affected by Hurricane Helene. A day earlier, Harris brought attention to the state of the presidential race.
This is going to be a very tight race until the very end.
Democratic Representative Adam Schiff was asked Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press whether he believes Harris and the Democrats can win overwhelmingly in November.
I think she can win overwhelmingly, given how divided the country is. Overwhelming may be winning by 100,000 votes or 80,000 votes in these key battleground states. Young people who are disengaged are now engaged, interested, active, volunteering. So I think we are well poised to win this thing, but it is still scary close.
The vice president will be busy with a series of media engagements this week, including appearances on popular talk shows her campaign announced. She's also expected to campaign in Nevada on Thursday and in Arizona on Friday. The Trump campaign website says the former president will travel to Pennsylvania on Wednesday to give remarks in Scranton and hold a rally that same day in the city of Reading. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
And that wraps it up for us this Monday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed this broadcast, head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Riziki by Jamnazi If Africa. We've been listening to the song Riziki by Jamnazi Africa. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Helen Cordian, and producer, Kwame Afore, thanks for tuning in today. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Shara nyingi mwafanya usiku, chai kwa mkate sasa mwauza usiku, mahindi choma sasa mwauza usiku, mali mali sasa mwauza usiku, hata maombi nyingi mwafanya usiku, koinange muna tafuta usiku, wake kwa waume shughuli zenu usiku.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In June of 2022, President Joe Biden convened nearly two dozen countries to launch the Los Angeles Declaration on Migration and Protection. In doing so, we recognize together the need to strengthen regional cooperation to ensure safe, orderly, humane, and regular migration, and to help people live in their countries of origin, declared Secretary of State Antony Blinken during a recent UNGA side event.
Together, we're making it easier for migrants already in country to obtain legal status. For example, governments throughout the region are helping Venezuelans acquire lawful residency status. Colombia, Ecuador, Peru are at the forefront, advancing measures to fully incorporate migrants into their receiving communities and economies.
We're also promoting secure migration pathways to dissuade individuals from taking perilous journeys to our borders, explained Secretary Blinken.
Here in the United States, we've led one of the largest expansions of lawful migration, including through new humanitarian family reunification parole processes, and raising our annual target for refugee resettlement to 125,000, while also strengthening enforcement measures to discourage irregular migration.
The Safe Mobility Initiative equips individuals in Latin America with accurate information and an online process to apply for lawful entry into the United States, among other countries. The United States is also working to disrupt human trafficking and smuggling through visa restrictions and financial sanctions. We're cracking down on criminal networks, and we're applying similar measures against companies that charter flights and boats to facilitate dangerous, irregular migration routes, said Secretary Blinken. Under Vice President Harris, the Central America Forward Initiative has generated over $5.2 billion in private sector investments in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Secretary Blinken announced the United States will additionally invest more than $685 million across Latin America and the Caribbean.
These new funds include nearly $369 million to aid refugees, vulnerable migrant populations, and host countries, as well as $228 million in emergency food assistance for Venezuelan migrants and displaced persons in Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. Our assistance also provides $10 million to the World Bank's Global Concessional Finance Facilities work in Latin America and the Caribbean.
I'm confident that together we can move toward a hemisphere where migration is a choice made freely, pursued lawfully, said Secretary Blinken, and where all people can live with security, dignity, and opportunity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.